Welcome back to STPT. I'm Danielle Holland, using they, she pronouns, recording from unceded and occupied Duwamish territory, Seattle, Washington. This week celebrated Indigenous Peoples Day. You can stand in solidarity and support the Duwamish in their efforts at Real Rent Duwamish. When you're on stolen land, every day is Indigenous Peoples Day. So you can take action, calling politicians into account and calling police departments out when they engage in acts of violence towards Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples. You can work in allyship, advocacy, and community towards participatory government models and budgeting. You can support financially, from helping to cover legal fees of water protectors to funding those like Roxanne White, who are fighting for justice for murdered and missing Indigenous peoples and families, building on a history of 529 years of resistance. STPT is a podcast collective focused on amplifying the stories and voices of those dedicated to justice and collective liberation. By learning, relearning, imagining, holding space, and witnessing, we commit to a radical redefinition of relations with one another and the natural world. We choose to be fully present to this moment as we address societal, cultural, and political issues and engage with one another and all of you as to how we can imagine the world we deserve. You can help sustain our work by going to sorrytopodcasts.com and click on support what we're doing. And always like, subscribe, and share episodes with your friends and loved ones and help our community grow. This week, I was joined by NChem and Defo, and our conversation was fire. We dove into resilience, reclaiming joy, and centering love in every decision. It was such magic to get to share time and space with her, and I'm incredibly excited to share this conversation with you all. Here we go. Joining us this week on STPT is NChem and Defo. NChem is the founder and president of Lumos Transforms and creator of the Resilience Toolkit, a model that promotes embodied self-awareness and self-regulation in an ecologically sensitive framework and social justice context. Licensed as a nurse midwife, NChem also has extensive postgraduate training in complementary health modalities and emotional therapies. She brings an abundance of experience as a clinician, educator, consultant, and community strategist to innovative programs that address stress and trauma and build resilience for individuals, organizations, and communities across sectors, both in her home country in the USA and internationally. NChem is particularly interested in working alongside people most impacted by violence and marginalization. Welcome to the show, NChem.
Thank you so much. I am really excited to be in conversation with you and see what kind of magic happens in this space.
I've been really excited about this conversation and in thinking in preparation for it. So I'm in Seattle. I'm a single parent and the school year just started. And I've been thinking a lot about stress and particularly childhood stress as I've been witness to my child's own stress and experience during the pandemic, as well as their friends, as well as my friends' children. And I've been contemplating on how we learn or don't learn to listen to what our body is telling us. I was a child thumb sucker. And when I reflect on that now, I think it was like my particular coping mechanism to stress. Mm-hmm. And at some point, my parents did this nail polish thing that made it a horrendous experience. It was like heat and disgust, like if I were to suck my thumb. And so that outlet went away, but certainly the stress or the root of whatever was occurring did not. And, you know, I'm not certain like now, like how I dealt with that at that age or where it traveled to next, but I'm really curious to start off with asking about, from your understandings, not only what the ecology of stress looks like, but also what that looks like through the different developmental ages we go through.
How old is your little person?
9.
9's an interesting age. I think before 9, children are, for the most part, in the nervous systems of their caregivers. It's just my experience that whatever sort of state their caregivers are, whether that's their parent, whoever their primary caregivers are, the children are often in the same state. Like, you are hard pressed to find a child that is more settled than their parents. Right? So if the parents are like here, you're not going to find a child more settled. They're going to be either at or above where their parents are. After 9, it's almost like the child kind of like some of their nervous system. It's like kind of like they grow their own nervous system. And it is true that in advance of puberty, the adrenals have a little burst of maturation. So 9 is when I was in more private practice and seeing, clients one-on-one, 9 is a common age for people to bring their children, because the children are all of a sudden like, whoa, because their adrenals are like kicking up, but they're not quite pubescent yet, right? And oftentimes at that point, I got to the point in my practice where I said I wouldn't see children unless the parents were seen first. Because a lot of times if you settle the parent, and I'm going to make this analogy bigger, children have the opportunity to settle because, and I mean parent or caregiver. So if the caregiver is your anchor, right? Like I ran for a year a children's class, right? And super stressed out parents would drop off their children. The children would settle and then they'd be picked up by super stressed out parents. And I'm like, what are we doing here? Like, this just makes no sense. And so the ability for the anchor to be the anchor, to be settled, allows the child to come back over and over again. And so for children, I think about teachers, I think about caregivers, I think about all the people around the child are so important. And I take this analogy, I do a lot of organizational work. If managers and supervisors and directors and leaders aren't settled, they are essentially the parents of the system. Because very rarely do we have flat hierarchies. Mainly we have hierarchies in organizations in the West. And so they're often a family type structure. And so if that is not, you know, the anchors aren't settled. I mean, like if you get on a plane and the pilot's all like loopy and you're just like, oh, right. Like you're like, ah, or the flight attendants are like, you know, doing something, you're like, no, you're supposed to know what's going on. Like, right. Even if I know my job is to be the passenger and do passenger things, I need to know that the person driving the bus knows what they're doing and mm-hmm. is calm. So how it, you know, it's not quite your question. Your question is like, kind of like how it shows up at different ages. I think stress is contagious. It is, because we are mammals. We live in connection, and it's about survival. Often stress is about a defense, a need to perform, a need to do something around feeling unsafe in some way. And that's contagious. And so we share, there's a collective nervous system for sure, within couples, within families, within organizations, within companies. There's a collective nervous system too. So that I think there's both of those. And so stress, I mean, it shows up in different ways. Some of it is biological in the body. And I think coming into that, a big part of my work, the goal is to help people, and people, I mean, individuals and collectives of people, to become into a self-awareness of where their systems are in that stress, trauma, relaxation. Where are they? What kind of maps can we use to understand ourselves as individuals? And then also for an organization to do some of, or, you know, a collective of people to look at their collective nervous system. So how does that, in self-reflection, because it offers up choice points. When you begin to understand how you, like, when I feel this, like for a person, when my jaw is a little tight, I wake up, my jaw is a little tight. Or I feel that little in my belly, or I notice my speech is a little clipped, or I'm a little impatient, or I just, it's like everything kind of has like a cast over it of negativity. I'm having a hard time seeing the big picture. there's a little tension in my body. Like, how can I read these cues? And then it's not enough to read the cues. How do I notice in like meetings with people or in conversations with people that we're not listening to each other? We're talking over each other, that we're impatient to get to the point. We're not hearing. When I notice those things, to like kind of notice them and then appraise, is this like useful? Like, are we in an emergency and we need to, like, someone needs to take charge and say, like, we're doing this. Okay. That makes sense. Or, hey, like, you know what? I need to be hypervigilant around COVID infection. Like, it is important that I'm like, are they wearing their mask? Are they, you know, that's useful. And not to shame myself for not being always settled or always in this, like, kind of this nirvana of connection that's supposed to look a certain way, that's what's needed in the moment. It's adaptive. And part of my health is my capacity to adapt. The problem is I think many of us lose that adaptive capacity and we go into these default responses because they've kept us safe in the past, because they were handed down in our families or our communities, or it's cultural to have this kind of response, and they're default. They're not interrogated, they're not explored, and they're not always so adaptive. Yeah. And so when we can start to have the awareness of like, is this working here or is it not? And then the choice point opens, right? But yeah. What's the choice point? The choice point is, wow, I'm really over-responding. How can I settle myself? And how do I know I'm settling myself? That's the whole resilience toolkit that I've developed, right? Is these questions. But the other questions also that exist around here that I have become more and more obvious to me is, you know what? My response is great, nothing to do. Beyond that, my response is perfect for this situation, but this situation is hella toxic. Hella toxic. And I'm here over and over and over again. So while I'm adapting, it's killing me. And at that point, the choice becomes either I change this situation or I leave. I vote with my feet. And that too, because as I've been like refining this work that I do in the Resilience Toolkit, that I realize is the entire, it's not just like a system for like settling your stress or being aware of your stress. It's like a system for, or an approach for knowing myself, opening up choice points and putting myself in situations that nurture me, that feed me, that are liberatory, or creating those situations. And part of it is the self-awareness, your original question, how do I know what is the stress showing up as in myself? And that's the first question we have to ask before we can even see it in someone else. So that's a long-winded, round the corner, over the bend, open some doors, in some boxes.
That made me think of so many different things. But the last part of what you said made me think about like when we're in different like work or organizational spaces, if you are doing the work to create like liberatory space within a structure or system, that is not that space, to whatever degree of toxicity, white supremacy, anti-queer bias, whatever the things are that create that. It is not to an individual's benefit to be doing that work, just like in existence in that space. I feel like, you know, the idea of conflict within a culture of toxic positivity can be looked at as though the person who's pushing for change, pushing for impact, pushing for liberation within a space, it's hard work, and it's often not like a rewarded job. That I think so many people do that work and keep busting themselves until at some point, like their body is breaking down, they're in the hospital, and they're like, I got to get out of here. And maybe everyone was like, after the fact, you did so much to change this place. This place wouldn't be what it is without you, which is kind of like an interesting thing. And I don't know. It's just interesting how systems with their feedback loops. And it's really difficult to do the work to break into interrupting that.
So, you know, it's a huge part of work that I do is exactly what you're talking about. And it's become in like increasingly like bigger and complex systems. So the one that I'm working on right now is like got 33,000 employee workforce.
Oh, wow.
it's a healthcare system and it serves, you know, almost a million patients. It's like bonkers level, right? The complexity of that. So it's something I actually wrote to myself this morning. Like the dialectic is typically be the change or make the change, right? It's the dialectic. Be the change, which can be toxic positivity. I'm all the things, right? Like that, you know, I'm in that state. And then making the change means some dismantling, which that's some fight. Like you said, push, you did a gesture like this, yeah. Right? That's making the change. That's not, you don't want to live, like you need to fight against, you know, injustice, right? Yes. But I don't want to live, I often say, I don't want to live in a fight world. Right. So if I'm always fighting, am I building, I'm dismantling things, but what am I building? More fight crisis culture, like more extraction, more, you know, domination, more violence, like, right.
So I just like perpetuating what you're already complicit or engaged or submerged within.
Right. So this is, we can't use the master's tools to dismantle them. You know, this is the saying. However, if I'm always be the change, be the change, be the change, like that, you know, I think of, you know, going from Audre Lorde to Frederick Douglass, like powers concedes nothing without demand, right? So be the change cannot necessarily do the work of make the change, that they're both necessary. And I've, you know, come to realize that the ability, that self-awareness of what state am I in a be the change or make the change state? And is it appropriate right now? And the ability to shift my state based on what I need, like, hey, we are, you know, coming up with a list of equity demands and we're doing da, 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 and this kind of thing. And then that's a make the change and, right? Like we're implementing or, and the be the change is like the visioning, right? The connecting. All of this stuff that happens in that space. And so the ability to know when is it useful to be in which stage comes with self-awareness and the, and that flexibility and fluidity for choice. But I, this morning I was like, false dialectic. Like, I don't know. Sometimes when you see something, you're like, maybe it was like just that full moon Pisces, something going on, like, just like, and when you can't unsee something. And I woke up this morning and I've been working towards it. So it's not, doesn't land. It's not like a big step from where I started yesterday, but I woke up this morning. I'm like, it's not, it's beyond the dialectic of be the change, make the change. It's practice the change, practice the change. And so this is what I wrote this morning. Let's find this here. It's dissolving the change to outcome highway, right? Like you're like, I'm going to do a change. And this is going to be our outcome. We're going to do this and we're going to have equity. It's letting the change be the gardener, the soil, the seed, the water, the fertilizer, the fruit, and the person eating the fruit. Every little bit is transformed in the act of changing. And so when we practice it, right? We're actually practicing and we are, the change is in everything. So as I'm doing, this is a big anti-racism initiative I'm doing. And people, you know, there's often like, it's in healthcare. Where's the outcome? Where's the deliverable? And I said, look at how we're running, conducting meetings, how people's voices are heard. This is a deliverable. It's in the process. How we're relating to each other, how we did recruitment, how we're doing leadership selection. Like the how, the process is actually the outcome. And so what I like about this perspective is that it gives us hundreds of opportunities to make change because it's in the doing. It's how I sign the email. It's how I listen. It's how I sleep. Like in every like little thing, it's how am I, and you know, lately for me, especially though this has been building over a number of years, is thinking of, you know, like bell hooks, the love ethic. This love ethic, if I center love in every decision, I'm practicing love. And in like, you know, love is justice, love is care, love is accountability,
love is respect, love is compassion, like all of those things. And so if I keep centering that as I make decisions, as I move, as I feel, it's happening. I am the change and I'm making change in the process. And so it's starting to dissolve again, some of this hierarchy. And this is like, again, my thinking just had a jump, or my experience just had a jump from yesterday to today, although I've been playing with these ideas a lot in, and I practice a lot. So I am an extroverted thinker in conversation. This is why I said the magic that happens in conversation when people ask questions and I'm new ideas that could only happen here, or new ways of looking that could only happen here arrive. And in I'm totally a practitioner. So it's, you know, I'm taking on this huge project, huge multi-year project. And I said, right up the start, we're going to make mistakes because we're doing something that's never been done before. An embodied anti-racism initiative in healthcare for workforce and patients. No, it's never been done before. So we don't know what that looks like. And people are like, really, is that okay? And like how to lean into the uncertainty and use these guideposts of these values and practicing and seeing what happens. And then the theory, like there's theory to start, but I love to test it and it shapes it and it comes alive and I learn more in the doing. So.
This is so juicy and radical and antithetical, I think, to so, I don't know. I've been thinking a lot lately about like benefit corporations and B Corps, and it surfaced for me because you said be the change, and this movement of like B Corps, largely across the United States and then some internationally, you know, they co-opted Gandhi's quote and they're in this be the change kind of phrase. And it's very much still, you know, these are the founders of the overseeing body are, you know, thought leaders, TED speakers. They come like, you know, they're all cis, hetero, white, privileged men who come from certain backgrounds and they are spoken about at Davos and stuff like that. And they've made this whole thing about, you know, triple bottom lines. And I think it was this push like from the early aughts to now of this like idea of like woke capitalism, where to me it's really surface level. And I think that you really showed it right there with like, with, I mean, from B and then like really like where can you actually go and travel to? Because it's like, we're going to check off these boxes. We're going to do these metrics. We're going to say these words so often that we actually lose all integrity of what these words even mean. Like, I think they don't mean anything anymore. And what I've been really cognizant of, like, I don't think a triple bottom line actually exists. I think that it's gaslighting. I think late stage capitalism is gaslighting us and has taken language from movement spaces and social justice spaces to extract and to gain and to do these same things. Like they're not questioning the systems and they're congratulating themselves within it without doing like the work of really questioning who is moving forward and who is moving back and who am I to like set the framework for what this work is. Like, am I the right person? Do I have this lens? I just think it's a lot of repetition of the harmful systems that we see, only now it's being sold to us as like better than, and I think it's kind of bullshit. I mean, so it's fascinating to think about the magnitude of such a project. Wow.
I mean, it's actually interesting. I've wanted to be B Lab certified for a while. We are a social enterprise, Lumos, that I start Lumos Transforms, and just haven't really had the time to actually get the certification, take the accreditation to do it. But I chose a social enterprise because of the fluidity of it. Even if it's for profit, it's like the lack of like, there's an entrenched bureaucratic structure in the nonprofit. Like, I don't think nonprofits are any better. In the, you know, it's kind of like, what am I? So I just thought I can move.
I know a lot of, options need evolution, don't they? Or like,
you know, like a worker co-op would be ideal. But I, at that point, like I was the one who had the most skin in the game and no one's like, we don't want to work as hard as you do. Sorry. Sorry. We don't want to work that hard. I'm like, good. You know, you want to work, but like what we need to get this off the ground and it's off. I'm just at this point, right? Like, where it's a little hazy what the future looks like for me. And I'm actually like, all right with that. I took a class. I didn't finish it. It's still in my recordings. I need to finish it. My list is so long. A list of unread. I actually heard the song, I have to say. It's Stack of Unread Books at the Bedside is the name of the song.
Oh, and my goodness.
Like, that's... I feel seen. I feel seen. Thank you.
My entire apartment.
Right? Like the tabs, the half-read tabs, the courses that I've started. Okay. You can say Gemini Moon 12th house. I don't know what to say, but like, there we go. So the class was called Hosting and Complexity. And it really like gave some language to the way that I was already moving, but understanding that in complex systems, it's principles that will be your guideposts. Cause they're we love algorithms or checklists or best practice, you know, but they fall apart in complex systems. And we are at a moment of intense complexity. If COVID has shown us nothing about the interconnectedness of ideas and people and systems, if we couldn't see it before, it is like right there, laying bare. What works, what doesn't, like it's COVID superpower. Let me shine a light over here. And so in complexity, it is really principles that are guides that I have found. I mean, I found it organically. It's the way like when I run a certification program and the way I design that certification program, it's complex, you know, helping people help other people develop this level of resilience and these capacities. And I use a principle-based approach. And in like consulting, often like, you know, organizations will have, or a leader or coaching, they'll have we have this quandary. And I realized that I had been using a principle-based approach, but to have it named was so useful. Like I'm a big fan of making the explicit implicit, the implicit explicit. Let's flip that. And because then you can be more intentional about it. And so this idea of principles, like, so if love is the principle, or if safety is the principle, or if cultural humility or collaboration is the principle. So when you come up, like, what are my core principles, my core values, right? If you have those and you come up against a quandary, you're at what's what principles help guide our moment to moment decision making in uncertainty, in complexity. And so when I'm at that point and I say, what do I do here? And I say, well, if love was the center, if collaboration was the center. So I was in like some quandary last week, and I get a lot of like shower epiphanies. I know we're California's in a drought and I really shouldn't, but I'm like, you know. It's like one, yes, we all have our things. So it was a little long shower. And I was in this quandary trying to figure something out myself. And I'm like, okay, come on, what's the principle? Let me bring in collaboration. So if I centered collaboration at this quandary, I'm like, instantly, this tight, narrow tunnel I had found myself in opened up. And I was like, who are the collaborators here who hold so much wisdom for the answers? Boom, the problem just dissolved. Because I was trying to hold it myself.
Yeah.
And once I brought in that principle, or if I say love is the center here, where are there places where I'm being, like love has a body center, like the center of gravity of love is here in the heart. It's not in the head, but it emanates and influences our head and the rest of our body. And so when I, you know, was like, what do I say here? And I'm like trying to think it through. And I'm kind of, you know, here. And I'm like, what if I center love? I drop into a heart space. It informs an opening of my mind to entertain a different way of positioning myself and of engaging from this place of openness that, you know, fantastic. So letting like that process of defining what are the principles that are guiding me in as I move. And I'm one where, you know, my work is an expression of my being and my relationships are an expression of my being and vice versa. There's not a lot of separation. And I like my work persona and my social persona. I mean, I can be more silly and irreverent and socially, but that there's this same core set of principles that are guiding me in all of these interactions. I think of like relationship anarchy, which I practice. It's the same. It's the same set of core principles, whether this is a work relationship, a family relationship, as a parent. And again, it's the principles that are guiding me. And even if that principle is joy and pleasure, what happens if I center joy and pleasure? It's not always that I'm going to center like stern things.
So I was just talking to a friend this week about the centering of pleasure, and like so much of our lives within the capitalist system and people's need to work in a survival mode limits like any type of space to center that or to explore that or to have that. And whether that's a hurried, rushed single parent who never sits down to eat, like doing a thing like while taking in food, right? To, oh my goodness, I was reading Girlhood by Melissa Phoebos, and I think it came out like this past year or last year maybe. And I know that she had like a whole bunch of research assistants in this book, so I'm certain that the statistic is correct, but it was still like in hetero relationships in 2019, like 27% of like women in those partnerships were having orgasms. And I was like, that fucking number hasn't changed at all since when I was a teenager. There is a whole lot of like non-self-centering of pleasure that's still occurring. I mean, in all the different like spaces that we could have like, that.
You know, that work to survive and everyone's like, just like mad hustle, you know.
Grind culture.
Totally, grind culture. And that actually a lot of the pleasure that people experience is a disembodied pleasure. It's an escapist. So it's like, I worked all day, fuck it. I'm not cooking myself a nutritive meal. I'm going to sit down and eat ice cream. I deserve it. Or I'm going to have that drink, or I'm going to hit that. And so we do these things because it's like, I've worked so hard. I deserve it. It's an indulgence. Like this idea of indulgence, there's nothing wrong with indulgence, but when we do it, we're doing it in an escapist way. We're actually not present. We're like zoning out in it. And to me, actually, like when you eat that ice cream, it, you know, whatever you're doing could be an incredible sex, whatever it is, incredible sensual pleasure, but it's done in a disembodied way because it's about escaping, not about being in it.
Oh my God. It's like you're stuck in this alt world of hashtag treat yourself instead of like actually embodying what that is.
And I'm not going to say like, you'll see these like little things like, you know, self-care isn't all bubble baths and chocolate. Yes, that's true. But it's not the thing that you're doing, whether you're scrolling on Instagram, whether you're gaming, whether you're having sex, whether you're eating, whatever. It's not the thing. It's how are you doing it? Are you aware? And not in the sense of like, you have to like be like super mindful in this minutia kind of way, but are you aware of the pleasure? Are you, you know, are you home? Are you home when you're doing this, or are you escaping? And so you can dial in when you do any of these practices, or you can use them to check out, centering back into this idea of what your self-awareness is. What is embodiment? I don't think it's possible to have pleasure without embodiment. I think it's something else going on. Like I'm actually running. I'm numbing or I'm running. I'm numbing or I'm running is a lot of what people, the treat yourself stuff is. And it makes me sad because it's like so much is taken from us in these systems. And like the reclamation of joy in an embodied way is such a fierce form of resistance in its absolute gentleness and compassion and celebration and silliness.
And there's so much like co-option of these things. It's like you could see an organization or company incorporating like, I don't know, some sort of topical conversation about rest for resilience and breaks or something in the workspace, but like it's centered in not love, not humanity, like whatever it could be possibly centered in, it's centered in like increased productivity. Like it's just to obtain a capitalist goal. It's not actually, I mean, so.
Absolutely. But I was having this conversation with a big healthcare union last week. And I actually said, doing this work does make you more effective. And they're like, well, that's the man's line, right? And I said, hold on a second. There's another layer of complexity. If doing this work, you're in a service profession, that's part of your identity and gives you meaning. Mm-hmm. And when you don't feel effective in your work, it is like a crushing to your identity. And this is like a lot of the moral injury that healthcare workers and COVID heavy, like, you know, are facing, is that they can't do their job the way they want to do their job well because of the volume, and they're so strapped for resources and understaffed. And so there's a moral injury around, I can't do this. And so the idea of how do we, like, I'm all about like getting in there about the nuance of things, is being effective. Like, do I let my boss decide what effective means to me? Like, if effective means to me that I feel powerful and competent and helpful in serving people, then yes, I want to be effective. If effective means to you that you want to extract every little last ounce of my humanity in production, then no, I reject that definition. It's like resilience. You can reject, like, resilience can be used. Hey, you need to be more resilient. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I don't care if you're working three jobs. You should be more resilient. I don't care,
like,
if you're
hungry. Like a threat or something, right, put upon you. Yeah.
But then on the other side, I'm like, resilience is a fucking amazing word. And I want to reclaim that. And I want to say, I want to be flexible. I want to be strong. I want to bounce back. I use the phrase alchemical resilience, thinking Erwin Ambrose for coining this. Is this idea of, can I be strong enough and flexible enough here that, and have enough capacity that I not only can bounce back against adversity, but I have enough bandwidth to look at the systems of adversity that were pushing me on the first place and transform them? I want that kind of resilience. So I'm not going to let, like, I'm reclaiming the word and redefining it. And also calling out when it's used in a punitive way, resilience, yeah, or effective, being effective, because they can be punitive. But it just, and again, this idea of how these ideas come to me in conversation, it was only in conversation with this union, these folks from this union, that I got clear. I'm like, no, we can reclaim effective. Effective is not a bad thing. But when it's at the expense of humanity, I am not here for that. What is in part of reaffirming my humanity and it feels good to be good at things. Not in a perfectionist way, but it feels good to be effective. Like, I'm an effective mom. I cared for my kid. I fed my kid. I was listened to them. That's a good feeling. That's okay for us to say. We going wide, we going deep. We're traveling.
The conversation about resilience brings me back to just that image that you shared at the beginning with like a stressed out parent dropping off a child and be like, here, you go get fixed. And then coming back here, right? Like just recognizing like the full, you know, context and web, it doesn't exist in a silo. And I've seen that in my life. I have actually seen that specific example of like, oh, we'll put the kid in therapy, but we're not going to do anything. We're not going to hold that space. So what does it mean to really acknowledge like the full world we live in, the ocean we swim in, the resilience outside, yeah, of just like the individual? But what does it mean, or what are maybe some examples of how one practices alchemical resilience?
Before I do that, something just came to mind.
Oh, yeah.
Can I bookmark that question? Can I say this thing? Can I say it?
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to say this thing. So I'm trained as a midwife. I'm a nurse midwife. And I haven't attended a birth since like 2007. But it was really, I still consider myself a midwife. I just don't midwife babies being born. It's just transformation and change. But it really informed a lot of my work with watching how people grow and transform, especially like birth is such a crucible. And it became very clear to me in working with families. I had a home birth practice for a number of years, and that I was like, what is this setup? Because what happens? So this is the scenario I would see. Like a kid does something, like they go and like run, that's something that's dangerous, right? Put their finger in a socket, go get a knife. I mean, something that's not okay. And the parent seeing that gets upset and like says something, right? Like, you know, like, what are you doing? Right. And, you know, so they're triggered and the kid is like, whatever they did. And so we have this moment of the kid is now scared because the parent is upset. And then the enlightened parent who has taken the parenting classes and knows how to like says, oh, I see that you're upset, right? Like they're supposed to drop in, like they have all their upset because they were scared their kid was something was going to happen, but they're supposed to somehow park that miraculously and see their kid and say, I see that you're upset and, you know, whatever, like really reflect their feelings and be there to co-regulate with the child. But what happened to the parent? Right? Like the parent was upset. Where did that go? Where is the space for it? Because in a nuclear family, let alone single parent, I was a single parent for many, many years, is the, where do we go? Where does upset go? And I realized the nuclear family, what happens is the parent is upset, the kid is upset. Well, let me actually, if we had like a more like village type situation
where there's more players, right? And roles.
The kid goes running off to grandma or cousin or auntie and sits on someone's lap. And that person says, tell me what happened. And oh, that was really hard. And that person who wasn't involved in the interaction is able to really co-regulate with that kid till they settle. And the parent goes off and talks to their sister or their this or their that and says, can you believe my kid did this? Oh my goodness. And they get the witnessing by their peer. Yeah, that's really hard. Oh my, yes, until the parent settles. So now you have a settled parent and a settled child, and they come back together, or caregiver, whatever, for a reunion. And now it's really genuine where the parent can say, yeah, I got really upset and you were upset too. It's like, and there's this reunion, right? But we don't have that space, especially COVID. Even if you built it, COVID like kind of ruptured that for a lot of people. And so what you see instead is an upset parent who either compartmentalizes and then uses the words, but their body is sending a completely different message. And the kid is like, what's going on? My parent is so upset that they're saying like all these nice things. Or what happens instead is the kid goes off, you have this kind of like awkward thing, and the kid goes off into a book or into a device, and the parent goes off into a book or device and regulates there. And so then this big thing is like, especially not too much screen time, cut down screen time. That's like sometimes the only way people know to regulate, because they don't have enough space and connections that are healthy to support what needs to happen in that. And so it's a setup. It's a setup to fail. It's a setup to fail. The nuclear family is a setup to fail around regulation, around learning nervous system regulation and being able to witness one each other. You know, authentically, especially with a little person that really can't tolerate you to separate and regulate before coming back in to connection. So these are things that I, you know, it is hard. Where can we find some individual solutions, but also some collective solutions that help support our biology and our how we're wired for connection and what the possibility of healing connection instead of this fractious experience. And so that alchemical resilience starts with, to come back to your question, me as a parent to recognize I am hella triggered. And anything I'm going to do right here, like, do I have space? Is this child old enough to, even if they go into a device for a little bit, that I can pick up the phone and call somebody and I can settle myself to recognize my own activation and what do I need and what helps me settle or go and, you know, stretch or do something and then come back and authentically, even if the kid was in a device for a little bit, is to be able to authentically engage. And that shifts the way we're connecting and how we do repair in our relationship. That is a transformation. That is an alchemy of, you know, of a sort. Through that awareness and then exercising that choice, I can create a different way of relating to my child. I think of another example. I was working with an executive leader yesterday who was talking about how he was engaging, presented a plan requested for by his directors that he came up with, and he presented it to them. They requested it. And then trying to get feedback from them about it. Like, did they like it? Did they not like it? What to do? And people were really silent. And he's like, why weren't people contributing? And so we did some investigation, and the ability to recognize the stress activation that he carried when it was silent and how that might have contributed to people feeling less safe to sharing. What were the things that he could have done in his own self-awareness to make more space and more room for connection, which would transform the culture of leadership at his organization? And that's the alchemy, the awareness, the choice point. And this was after the meeting, right? But what was the learning? And he realized, if I can settle myself in this moment, suddenly I see more options and I can invite more collaboration in a different kind of way with different kind of language instead of, anyone have any questions? What questions do you have? Because he drops and settles. Let's get curious together. What might make this work? What might block this? Is a very different way of relating, which is working towards the kind of culture that he wants in his organization. But coming through that embodied place, let him get there. Because otherwise we could give you strategies. Do this, do this, do this. But it's like the parent speaking to a distressed child when they're distressed. They don't land well. They're inauthentic because they're not sitting in the body. Is that helpful to think about some?
Another example? It's incredible. It's incredible because of how powerful it is when you think about all the repercussions and how that reverberates out. You know, what, like if I, as a parent, having ownership and time over like my experience and like the space that I'm holding and who I am when I'm with my child, like, what is that teaching them versus, you know, sucking everything down, repressing everything down, like pushing everything. I don't know. It's going to come out somewhere. And then lying, you know, because that's what it is. It's kind of like a mask of something instead of being, well, I'm not.
I would have more compassion around it. There aren't, parents don't have a lot of options here. This is right? Part of the system. And so it's not enough. There aren't, yeah. This is not enough for individual solutions. But when you're parenting, you have no bandwidth to think about collective solutions because this is why having an effective stress response. I always say, what's your lowest effective stress response for any given moment? And this was a lesson to me out of my own chronic illness where I could not, I had to really pace myself in terms of my energy because it was very, very limited. And I had to be very judicious. I'm really going to spend 25% of my energy on something that could take 10. So learning how to modulate my energy expenditure was also the same thing around stress. If you are over responding, you're wasting energy that if you could recognize it and settle yourself, you reclaim that energy. Then you say, wow, I actually do have some extra bandwidth for the transformation, for the collective solutions, for like, how do I build a community of intention around to support me as a parent and other parents? How do we do this collectively, not me lifting myself? So having an effective, coming back to that same word, stress response actually benefits us because there's a lot of waste.
Yeah.
Those over responses are just a waste.
It's a lot of practice. I like the idea of like with that practice though, of being able to work towards what that thing is. And because I've often, you know, when I assess, like, and I'll think of it with greater compassion for myself at the moment. But when I think about like the disconnect between like where I'm at and like where I want to be within community, and especially because the pandemic siloed us like into our the tiniest of units and really disconnected us from the community that we had like physically. And I mean, it really, I think, unveiled and things that I had known, like truths that I have known, but I don't know how to get to the place of like, this is the kind of space that I want to be in with like a village, so to speak, because it's like, how do I even create that in this society for myself when I live in a place without family, when I mean, just kind of all these things, you know, everything is structured around, like, as far as social nets go, everything is really structured around like a heteronuclear family as a support system. And, like that's not something I want.
So how are we do it in the practice? We can only prepare so much. We can only prepare so much. We've got to start practicing. So we have some ideas, and part of it is like, where is there a safe place to practice? It's not all places are safe. And where are the small ways that I can practice? So like a thing that I started when the pandemic was a little bit better here in LA, though we had a little bump and now we're down again, but still Delta. I started a Sunday afternoon park thing. I just made a big WhatsApp list and said, you know, anybody who's interested, you want, I'll add you to the WhatsApp list. And Sunday at 4, I will be in the park. If you're around, there's no pressure at all. Slide through a little bit, a lot. We're, you know, for a few weeks, we were unmasked in the park. Now we're masked because of where COVID is right now. And some people come, bring their dogs, you know, some kids, whatever it is. But the reestablishment of that connection. And I've done this at various times in my life. This will be the third series that I've done. And many of them have run for decades. But in the pandemic, I had my chronic illness was really bad. And then as I was recovering, the pandemic hit. And so I really didn't have that. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to rebuild this. And it's just starting to get a little flavor. Depends who's coming. Someone came and says, can we knit together? I'm like, sure. Like, let's see what, you know, but people start talking. And I remember, you know, in the past, what would happen is like, re-glued folks back together, and you could kind of hear that check-in, how you're doing for the week, or if someone needed something, you're like, oh, maybe, you know, it's time to pop by and check on them this week. Or it's been really, really beautiful. And it's an hour of the week, right? And so it was a little thing, but I can feel what it's doing. And my goal is like, can I magnetize this space and time? Can I magnetize it for folks to connect and reconnect, folks who don't know each other to start knowing each other, folks to re-know each other? And that, like, we don't have to have all the answers.
Yeah.
It's going to be hazy in the distance, because as we do things, it's going to change what the next thing happens. It should be, right? We're responsive. So we do one thing and it shifts. And even if I thought the next thing was coming, it's like, no, now it's something different. And to be open to that, and if you're centering, what's the centering the values or centering the principle, I can only imagine that when you center a principle, that things will organize around it. So I'm like, I'm planting this seed in love. I'm watering it in love. I'm feeding it in love. I'm eating the fruit in love, right? And seeing what happens. And I honestly don't know. And so when you say like, I'm in these systems, like, how can I possibly build something? And I'm like, you absolutely can. You absolutely can. You just don't know what it looks like yet. And that's, of course, we don't know what it looks like yet because we haven't experienced it.
I love that. Being present and curious to what presents. Yeah. Oh, I know we're coming to the end of our time. I feel so moved and like lit from inside with just, I don't know, maybe that love energy and just some things I'm going to be taking with me as I move away from this conversation and allow it to just like seep in and have its impact on me.
Like, what if you act like the thing that you're looking for is actually already here? What? Just pretend the thing that you're looking for is already here. How would you be different? What would you do differently? So that's, I think, the practice. It's both the being and the making in one. If the thing you're looking for is already here, what would be the next phone call you would make? And what would you say? How would you make your lunch? How would you eat your lunch? What would your dream look like?
Well, looks like I've been asking myself the wrong question.
I don't know. There's so many questions.
Right? I love that. And I actually, you know, what I'm going to do with that, and I invite our listeners too as well, is to do some journaling, like really use those as some prompts as far as how we're thinking, how we're imagining, and you know, what it is we're creating. I love that. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's like, I'm in here doing this, right? I'm in here like, what's happening here? Like, relationships have been a big teacher for me. My work has been a big teacher. My chronic illness, a big teacher. And like a lot of joy. There's been grief and loss and heartbreak and anger and terror and all of the things. And I'm so happy to be alive, like so happy to be able to feel all those things and have the ability to feel all those things, to be in my body after so many years of not. No, I'm like these days I'm full of hope and on fire, and it hasn't been easy. Like, it hasn't been easy, but I'm here for it, all of it. And we're going to make mistakes. Like, promise you, we're going to make mistakes. They're going to be messy. We're human. Thank God we're human and not robots.
Thank God. I know our scheduled time is up, yeah. But like, do you have time for like, something is burning at me? If I can like,
do it. I'll be okay.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I want to honor your time. Okay. I have no idea like really what this means when you say it, and you said it earlier in the conversation, relational anarchy.
Relationship anarchy.
Mm-hmm. Relationship anarchy. I want to know like,
relationship anarchy. I check out Kim Tallbear. She's a indigenous.
I love her. She's incredible.
So she talks about relationship anarchy. Okay. Yeah. Like decolonizing. So she calls the colonial project of monogamy. The thing about relationship anarchy, so it's a type of polyamory, but it asks for all relationships, not just the people you're having sex with. It really asks a look at all of the ways that you relate to people. As a worker, in all of your roles, parent, teacher, sibling, lover, like all of the roles, not to prioritize just the relationships, the coupled relationships, what
romantic.
We call it, right? And really look at them, and can you center a set of values? And so if the values guide you, as opposed to some outside structure saying, this is how it has to be. And there is, you know, that when you don't compromise those values, we compromise all the time in relationships, but there's a difference between compromising core values and how liberating that is when you can be in your core values and connect with people in their core values. And that's the, you know, you foster that as the connection. So it's not a coercive connection based on these external structures. It's really like a generative internal connection. I didn't know the name for it. I practiced it.
This is the first time I've heard the name, like that name. I don't know. And I've read a lot of Kim Tallbear stuff, but like, I guess I did. I clearly haven't read enough, but I'm going to dive right into that because like that fucking speaks to me. Like, I love this.
Yeah. And so this is a place that we get to practice. For me, I'm practicing love in relationship. And like, so where I started in work relationships and familial relationships and romantic relationships, like I'm really interested in reciprocity. You don't get to reciprocity until you practice reciprocity. You don't get to, like, it's like in the doing, we figure it out. And so I'm here for it.
Thank you.
This has been such a joy. I want to thank you. I want to thank you so much. This is such a joy. And I'm glad, I know we rescheduled and I'm so glad we did, because I just had like a bunch of openings over the weekend, and you being in conversation with you helped clarify some things for me, myself, because I'm still evolving. Thank God.
Like, right? Thank
God, right?
Every day. Thank you so much. I'm it was just so beautiful to get to meet you in this space and to share time and space. And I look forward to, I don't know, maybe I'll be in Los Angeles in the park with you one day.
Oh yes. Or I'll be up in Seattle. I have a standing invitation, so I need to take someone up on that. So,
what would you direct our listeners to for learning more about either the Resilience Toolkit or anything that you're working on that you'd like to share before we close?
So my organization is Lumos Transforms. You can find us on all the social platforms, and the website is, you know, lumostransforms.com. And then the resiliencetoolkit.co. You can find more information about that, that approach. That's probably where you're going to find. I'm on Twitter and Instagram personally. I'm kind of an intermittent poster. I'm actually an introvert, truth be told. But if I can center ideas and not myself, I can center ideas, I'm all for it. If I'm centering the work or liberation, I'm all for it. And so I'm a little intermittent. I'm trying to be better. But Lumos offers free classes. We've been doing it since the pandemic started on an introduction to this approach called anchoring resilience. And that's a good intro to take. Awesome. And just kind of hear the approach a little bit more and dig in. And then we have community-based classes, of which about 50% of the spots are scholarship, 100% free for accessibility to learn and go like deeper into it. It's like a 3-part series. And we have one for recovery as well, for people in recovery, like how to use this approach for recovery. So that's like a good intro. Awesome. And then as I get into more, you know, if you follow me, I'll post it.
And yeah, we'll share all of that in the show notes too.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You can become a listener supporter of Sorry to Podcast This, a small monthly donation to help sustain future episodes. Visit sorrytopodcastthis.com.
Thank you for joining us this week on STPT. Sorry to Podcast This is produced by Danielle Holland and Robin Thompson. Engineering, sound design, and original music by Carrie Williams. Our show art is by Anna Connor. You can like, subscribe, follow, and review on your favorite streaming platform, and become a listener supporter at sorrytopodcastthis.com. You'll find notes and more there as well. See you all next week. Bye.